This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. When Putin declared war on Ukraine in a televised speech last week, he said that with this occupation, Russia will, quote, seek to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. But the Nazis Putin warned of weren't the usual suspects of neo-Nazism and anti-Semitism. Figures like David Duke, the former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, whose anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, including the one that claims that Jews orchestrated the 9/11 attacks, didn't come up. Nor did he mean someone like Alexander Dugin, the Russian ultranationalist political thinker who writes in his book Konservativnaya Revolutsiya that, quote, the world of Judaica is a world hostile to us. To understand does not mean to forgive, but to vanquish. Where much of the world sees anti-Semitism, Putin sees allies. He claims the real Nazis are members of the Ukrainian government, like the freely elected and Jewish president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky. But according to Yale philosophy professor Jason Stanley, that very absurdity ties into one of the main anti-Semitic conspiracy theories prevalent in Eastern Europe today, inspired by the likes of Duke and Dugin, that Jews were behind the Holocaust and used the Nazis to persecute white Christian Russians, as Putin says is happening now. Stanley says this mockery of the Holocaust is a dog whistle to drum up support for war among those who share Putin's vision for a fascist Christian ethnostate.
To understand Putin's intentions, what we have to begin with is what denazification was. Invading Germany, capturing the Nazi leaders, executing some, imprisoning others, and then replacing Nazi ideology systematically in schools and institutions with liberal democratic ideology. So what does Putin mean? Putin means by denazification, he's going to invade Ukraine, put on show trials versus the trials of Nuremberg, where he tries the leaders of Ukraine, executes some, imprisons others, and then replace liberal democratic ideology with Christian nationalist fascist ideology.
Denazify means to get the Nazis out. I mean, does he identify a different group, perhaps far-right Christian nationalists, as the true victims of the Nazis?
He needs to gather popular support, and anti-Semitism is a popular base in Eastern Europe. This is not visible as much to those of us in the West. Eastern European anti-Semitism functions by saying that Jews stole the Holocaust narrative, that Eastern European Christians, those were the real victims of the Nazis. Of course, many Russian Christians were murdered by the Nazis. No one denies that. But vast majority of Eastern European Jewry was wiped out. So he claimed that there's a genocide facing Russian Christians in Eastern Ukraine, that Zelensky and others are neo-Nazis, and they're performing a genocide. This is an intentional mockery of the Holocaust, speaking to an anti-Semitic Christian nationalist Russian audience.
Following Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014, there was similar rhetoric from Putin about the fascist far-right nationalism in Ukraine and how bad it was. And at that time, it did seem to leave something of an impression on the West. It raised some questions and some eyebrows. Am I remembering it wrong?
No, you're remembering it absolutely correctly. I'm on the left, and many people on the left were convinced by this. Supporting that civic nationalism in the Maidan Revolution of 2014, you did have far-right elements. You had the Azov Battalion. You had some far-right Ukrainian ethno-nationalists. who reminded people of the past of World War II, where Ukrainian Jews were murdered not just by Nazis, but by Ukrainian nationalists. But in the 2019 election, the far right in Ukraine received 2% of the vote. You'd be hard-pressed to find any recognizably democratic country where the far right has that little support. Ukraine has embraced liberal democracy, where the nation is not the sort of ethno-nationalist Ukrainian Christian nation of the neo-Nazi imagination. When they elect a Jewish leader, when the far-right parties get so little support, you can be assured that the far-right is not in control.
Israel has avoided full-throated criticism of the invasion of Ukraine. After some back and forth, it eventually voted to support the UN Security Council's condemnation of Russia's actions, but it didn't vote for sanctions. How do you reconcile the alliance, albeit qualified, between Christian Russian nationalism and Jewish Zionist nationalism? Or do Christian nationalists just like the idea of Jews living somewhere else?
Christian nationalism is, of course, the view that Jews are fine as long as they're over in their own country. So Yoram Hazony, leading Israeli ethno-nationalist, came to speak at the National Conservative Conference in the United States last year and said the United States must be a Christian nation. And Israel has long cultivated the evangelical Christian right in the United States as an ally, which is why you see Israeli flags in many Christian evangelical spaces. The idea that every identity should have its own nation, every religion should have its own nation or nations, that is the ethno-nationalist idea. Israeli nationalists, they're in alliance with nationalists elsewhere.
So if Putin hoped to divide the West, most commentators say that he failed.
Right.
But he is trying to appeal, you suggest, to his fascist, far-right Christian brothers. To what end? To join the battle?
The idea here is that liberal democracy is the rot. It's a Jewish plot. And Zelensky, by being Jewish, almost embodies the anti-Semitic nightmare. You know, Hitler's idea was that Jews created liberal democracy to weaken the nation. And so you need a strong leader to fight it back, because liberal democracy involves tolerance, equal rights for everyone, regardless of their ethnicity or religion. So Putin is clearly linking his own autocratic reign, where he tortures and imprisons and kills dissidents, to this ideology that liberal democracy is a globalist, re-Jewish plot. This is going to strengthen the elements abroad that agree with him in one sense, but in another sense, it's going to separate them, because fascism is based on ethno-nationalism. It's based on identifying a strong ethnic and religious identity. And these groups have histories that clash. You know, that's really the saving grace for liberal democracy here.
Give me an example of what you mean.
So take Poland and Russia or Hungary and Russia. Why does Orbán, who is linked to Putin, ideologically similar to Putin, why did he come around in the end to agreeing with the sanctions and standing against Russia? Because the Soviet Union invaded Hungary like the Soviet Union is now invading Ukraine.
So how is that the saving grace?
The thing that unifies them is supposed to be, you know, we all agree that our nationality is the best. But there's a history of one of the nationalities fighting the other nationality for who will dominate. And Putin is a classic fascist. What we're seeing here, just absolutely no coherent justification, false claims that a genocide of ethnic Russians is happening elsewhere, just absolutely fictitious basis for conquest. And some of these nationalities, Hungary, Poland, have been the victims of Russian imperial aggression in the past.
Is Putin's world so different from ours that we're not even supposed to understand his rhetoric?
The rhetoric of denazification, there's an incoherence here, right? Because he's saying Ukraine is ethno-nationalist fascist, but it's also liberal democratic, and both of those are bad. They have liberal democracy, and so they're a threat, and they're ethno-nationalist fascists, and they're a threat. It appeals in multiple ways. Number one, it appeals to a sense of lost dignity of Russians. So fascist rhetoric is meant to make people think your country was great, and you need a strong leader to take it back from these minorities, from these people who are humiliating it. It's harshly anti-Semitic. It's saying the real genocide victims are ethnic Russian Christians. The Jews are the real agents of this genocide. This is meant to appeal to a domestic audience.
The former relatively moderate Russian president, now deputy chairman of the Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, moderate no more, he accused the Ukrainian people of losing their identity, which is Russian, and he described Zelensky as disgusting, corrupt, and faithless, having repudiated his Jewish identity to serve rabid nationalists. This meant, according to Medvedev, that Zelensky was like a Jewish Sonderkommando, a reference to the Jews in the camps forced to dispose of gas chamber victims during the Holocaust. Negotiations with such people in such a state, said Medvedev, is pointless.
There are different forms of anti-Semitism. There's a kind of old anti-Semitism directed against Judaism as a religion. That's not Nazi anti-Semitism. Nazi anti-Semitism is directed against Jews as supposedly these communists who are anti-religious. Goebbels and Hitler invade against Judeo-Bolsheviks who are corrupt, decadent, seeking to undermine the nation, simply power hungry. So this is the description he gives of Zelensky. Then he incoherently connects that with Ukrainian ethno-nationalist identity. And then he slanders Zelensky in the worst possible way by connecting him with the Sonderkommando.
Stephen Blank, who is a fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, says that Russia hopes that its words will resonate with Ukrainians on the belief that it can exploit what was true in the past, which was considerable anti-Semitism in Ukraine.
Yeah, it's appealing to Eastern European anti-Semitism and that Ukrainians will start to view Zelensky, their president, as anti-Ukrainian, who's a globalist bringing in liberal democracy. But what Russia failed to see is that Ukraine's already made its choice. When Putin says Ukraine is an existential threat to him, he's right. He's right because, you know, Ukraine is a hopeful democracy fighting corruption, allowing religious toleration, tolerance for LGBT across the board. And it's right there on the border of Russia. It's friendly to Russians. So it is a threat because Russians can like look over the border and say, wouldn't it be great if we had free and fair elections every few years?
Jason, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Brooke.
Jason Stanley is a philosophy professor at Yale and the author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. The BBC's Moscow news service has been blocked, as has Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, the German Deutsche Welle, Facebook and Twitter, and many more. But worst of all, Russia's tough, resilient, independent media outlets have gone dark. I'm talking about journalists who have withstood far more pressure than I can imagine. When I was a Moscow correspondent, I relied on Echo Moskvy, or Echo of Moscow, for clarity and guidance. It's closed. The courageous Latvia-based website Medusa is blocked, as is its lifeline to Russian crowdfunding. On Friday, Russia passed a law criminalizing so-called fake news, which is to say, real news. Violators could be slammed with 15 years in prison for writing anything that contradicts Putin's story of the war. TV Rain, Russia's last independent station, was shut down Thursday, but it left with a defiant and infuriatingly clever musical commentary. The music the Soviet Union played when blocking access to the news of the death of Leonid Brezhnev, also during the attempted coup of 1991. It's the sound of silence enforced by the state, but you can dance to it. On the Media is produced by Micah Loewinger, Eloise Blondio, Rebecca Clark Callender, and Max Balton, with help from Aki Camargo. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Adrian Lilly and Andrew Nerviano. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.